Okay, then we are going to the disclosure initiative.
Thank you very much. Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So we are here this afternoon to talk about our targeted standards level of disclosures project. It has been a while since we last brought this topic to the board table, and that is because we have spent the last 6 months being very busy talking about this project to many of our stakeholders. So given that it has been a while, I will just take a couple of minutes to remind you where we are in terms of project stage and to provide context for the session. So last year, the board developed a set of draft guidance to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements in future. The board also decided to test that guidance by applying it to two standards, being IAS 19 and IFRS 13. Now, the guidance placed a really strong focus on the development of detailed and specific disclosure objectives and the importance of basing those disclosure objectives directly on the needs of users of financial statements. In order to develop those objectives, the guidance is fairly clear that the board would need to consult with users and do something of a tailored outreach programme with them to understand their objectives in a great level of detail. Guidance also placed a lot of importance on outreach with other types of stakeholder to understand all of their views about the information that might best meet user needs. So, for example, thinking about stakeholder views on costs, audit consequences, regulatory consequences, those kinds of things. So the months of outreach we have done have really been aimed at gathering all of that information. And this stage of the project, and indeed everything that we're doing at the moment, is really done with two objectives. The first is to lead to improvements in the disclosure requirements of the two test standards themselves, but also, and perhaps even more critically, to test the application of the guidance and work out how we can improve it and make it as useful as possible. So with those objectives in mind, we have four papers for you today. The first one summarises the outreach that we've performed. Agenda papers B and C contain all of the technical detail in terms of the feedback that we've heard. And then agenda paper 11D summarises the approach that we are planning to take over the next few months in terms of bringing analysis and recommendations to the board. So inevitably, given the project stage, a large part of this meeting is about us sharing with you all of the detailed information we've heard from our stakeholders. This meeting is also extremely valuable to the staff for other reasons, because we're very keen to get as many of your wise words as we possibly can now before we start bringing some very detailed analysis papers to you over the coming months. So all that said, we will move on to talk about the papers. The first paper, agenda paper 11A, talks about the outreach activities that we have performed. So the first section of the paper summarises the tailored user outreach programme that I mentioned, and this was all done with the objective of gathering information to help the board develop detailed, specific and effective disclosure objectives. The paper summarises who we spoke to in terms of investor type, geographical coverage, and industry specialism, and in all of those ways we got a broad coverage with the users that we spoke to. The paper also summarises the questions that we asked and the way that we approached the meetings. The paper then goes on to explain our discussions with other types of stakeholder in light of what we'd heard from investors. And the final section of agenda paper 11A summarises our preliminary thoughts on lessons learned. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the ultimate test of the effectiveness of this outreach programme will really be the board's ability to develop effective objectives over the coming months. However, we did think it was worth recording at this early stage how we think it has gone so far and what we've learnt. A couple of key points that I would highlight from that section that relate particularly to the user outreach is that the process of having meetings with individual investors or very small groups of investors we felt was extremely effective because it did enable us to understand investor views in a level of detail that we think is going to prove extremely valuable to our upcoming analysis. That process did inevitably take a degree of time, and that is why you haven't seen us at the board table for a little while. But the final point we wanted to make on that was that from a staff perspective, we were really pleased and indeed extremely grateful that all of the investors that we spoke to really bought into this process. They spent a lot of time sharing a lot of detailed views with us. And as I hope you will see from Agenda Papers 11B and 11C, we think their buy-in in this process has given us information that will really help in the development of effective objectives over the coming board meetings. So with that summary, we will pause for any questions or thoughts on Agenda Paper 11A.
Catherine, Aisha, Siobhan, I think you've done a great job. Thank you for all the papers, all the detail, but all that great work that you have done. I think the papers convey to us the thoroughness of the approach that you've taken. So thank you for that. I think that in the paper, 11A, we're talking about you do make clear what our objective is, and I think that's incredibly important because we've actually set ourselves quite a hard task. We're trying to improve disclosure through disclosure objectives, so I think it's quite difficult. So this mapping out of what we're doing and why, really important. So a couple of specific points that relate to 11A. When you come down to paragraph 5, you talk about the disclosure, the specific disclosure objective in A, and then you go to B, there could be specific items. I think there's a third thing in there. There's an A, B and a C. There's an A, which is the disclosure objective, and there's a C, which is the could have, because there's also the required items.
Okay.
So this comes up in 11D, and you may want to talk about it there, but I think that somehow you have to also include the fact that there will be required items, not just a list from which people could disclose. Also, on the clarity, the idea of the clarity point, could you give some more thought to the way you talk about disclosure objectives and the objectives of users? Because there's disclosure objectives in a standard, and there's the objectives of users, what the users are going to do with the information. Now, I don't know whether you see those as just interchangeable things or whether not. And if we look at something like IFRS 15, the disclosure objective, it starts out the objective of disclosure in this standard is for user needs, is so that they're linked straight away. But what we get in these papers is what looks like being used interchangeably. And I think that just needs a bit of tidying up, if you just have a look at that.
Thank you. If I could respond to both of your points, actually, I think that the first one certainly is something we'd like to make sure we're absolutely clear on. So when we talked about all of this last summer and last September, when we got the draft guidance to a position to begin testing, we had many discussions about the prescriptiveness of the language that we would use with regard to items of disclosure as opposed to objectives. And at the time, what we talked about was prescriptive language around objectives, so an entity shall disclose information that enables users to do X, Y or Z thing, and there had been some strong debate about whether the items themselves should be equally prescriptive, whether there should be a bit more freedom there with the compliance requirement being around the objective. Where those discussions ultimately ended up was that we had said, and it does come up in 11D, as you mentioned, that once we had a point of moving through our test standards and we had real information to work with, a real set of objectives on our two standards, a real clear picture of the information that users would most like to see to meet those objectives, taking into account all of the other feedback we've heard, we would revisit that discussion. So I just want to be clear that I realise we've skimmed over it in these papers, in the footnote to the paragraph that you mentioned is quite short. That is something that we think is a critical upcoming discussion, But equally, we think it's important to get some real examples of the information we're talking about to facilitate that discussion. So I think the point is completely fair, and it's something that's definitely coming back. And the second point that you made about disclosure objectives versus user objectives, I also want to comment on, because I think that is a wonderful point. And again, it's probably reflective of us trying to communicate what we've heard without perhaps articulating it brilliantly in the paper. So perhaps it's just worth saying that we're not using the two terms interchangeably. We very much talk to users about their objectives as a way of facilitating a deep understanding for us of what they want to do, and we will use those in developing proposals for disclosure objectives. So we realise it's confusing use of language, and we will make sure to clarify. So thank you.
Nick?
Thank you. I was interested in paragraph 16, where you contrast the needs of the buy-side and sell-side users insofar that the sell side have more time to examine detailed disclosure requirements. I think they also like to be experts, and they also want to know everything, so we just have to be careful and a little wary that these add value in totality. And I think that follows through to a practical issue that we faced in this exercise, as far as I could see, and that it was more challenging to arrange meetings with buy-side investors. And partly it's perhaps that we haven't always had such direct contact with all of those, but equally, they're not always as reliable as following. They may agree to a meeting, and they don't always follow through on actually finally agreeing to a meeting. And it just means, I think, that we need to always be on the front foot with buy-side investors. We need to be going to them early and going back to them, make sure we're getting that input. You ask later on in the paper in terms of will this, you know, this has been an immense effort by staff, by board members, by stakeholders who we have spent time with, and, you know, how will this be justified? And I guess the ultimate test is, will we have improvements? Will we have those more relevant disclosures? And that will be the proof. I'm still hopeful we may also do something on the volume of disclosures at the same time, and that we can lose some of the less relevant disclosures. But I think it's really, that will be the test, the acid test of this process.
Thank you. I would like to commend the staff for the work being done in terms of outreach effort. I think it's an excellent example of how we could actually seek feedback from users, in particular from analysts or sell side, buy side. I think it was very good. Just one comment, suggestion for you. I won't be here when you do that. But you, when you mentioned further outreach planet, you didn't mention. You mentioned many groups that you've discussed, provided the feedback. But I would just suggest you to consider including the discussion with the EEG in their next meeting. Of course, in accordance with where the project is, and then you frame that. But I think it would be very important for us to give them the opportunity also to provide their feedback at some point, and to know how all this was developed, and to know a little bit more about the feedback.
Mary?
I'll start with adding my thanks both to the team and also to all the user stakeholders who participated in this, because it's clear that there's a huge amount of work that has been carried on, and lots of people have given their time. I am hopeful that if we, you know, continued something like this in the context of a standard-setting project rather than, you know, this is an after-the-fact review, that we would get some efficiencies from including it, you know, in the outreach on the whole package of proposals, not, you know, not just disclosures, as opposed to this always being a subsequent additional major effort. But I think we have to be realistic with ourselves, and both thank and warn the user community about what it will take in terms of their contribution to get that understanding that's here. But I think it's been a huge effort, and it really has paid off for our understanding. So very grateful for that. Catherine, I'm glad that you addressed the paper 11A, paragraph 5, because I'll just add my voice too. I'm really concerned about how we make that balance. So I think that's going to be quite a significant discussion. And the third thing I want to pick up on is your comment about the acid test will be when we see how well, you know, how much the general principles help the board to develop disclosure objectives. I think that's true, but I want to put a note of caution about that. I think it's a lot harder when we are retrofitting them to an existing standard for which we are not, first of all, rethinking recognition and measurement requirements, aggregation unit of account, and for which we have not been working recently, and we're not kind of in the zone in terms of thinking about what things are. So I think it is the right test to do, but I think you may want to give it some kind of grading curve when you think about, you know, how we're applying it in slightly more challenging circumstances.
Well, I would like to join all others for the appreciation of the approach, the work done, and the success in getting all the feedback. I would like to make two or three points. First of all, I think really in this approach, anchoring our requirements into objectives is what has the potential of bringing change. So, the focus, in my view, should be on these objectives. And when we render or discuss the results of the feedback, I don't think we should translate. I mean, we shouldn't present things as if the objectives had been there in order to help us identify the requirements. Of course, they do that. But really show them as being the focal point of the requirements and the detailed requirements being the supplementary guidance to help people design, in fact, what is really relevant in order to meet the objective. And when you mentioned that eventually the discussion with ASAF was not as effective or as positive, I don't know what your words were, as you would have expected, I think eventually the fact that those objective were not central to the papers that we were discussing with them may be an explanation of that. And I would not draw the conclusion that ASAF should be consulted at a later stage. I think the ASAF members here have more than once highlighted that they find their contribution all the more useful, that they're consulted, ask for input in advance of us making decisions and proposals, or in parallel. So that we can benefit from their input at the time that we make our tentative decisions. I thought that building up lessons learned as you go is excellent, because I think it's very serving well the purpose that we have, that the guidelines are iterative in their development. And on the basis of paper 11A, I stop here. Thank you.
John Wu. Thank you. I appreciate your good effort to, as other both members. Good. Just a clarification, you know, you said that the paragraph 31D, ASA asked us, you suggested, you know, we have a good consultation after the board has developed the proposals. So could you explain what specific proposals we have to make before our consultation with ASA?
Yes, I can. So just to reiterate, I mean, those lessons learned points are kind of things to consider rather than, you know, cold hard, this is what we will do. But one of the things that was said at ASAF was that some members might have found it easier to almost consult and comment at the stage of the board having a set of disclosure proposals. So, for example, a set of proposed amendments to IAS 19, say. So that's not to say that it's not also useful to consult earlier, but they did highlight that might be a point when they can contribute some detail.
A very specific disclosure requirement they would like to see from us before having kind of a big advice to us.
I think the point at which we have developed some proposed amendments would be a time when they would find it good to consult with their constituents and give us feedback. Yeah.
Anne?
Can I just add something for paragraph 31? You're talking about your initial thoughts about effectiveness. I think there's two more things you can add there. One is the fact of the two standards that were chosen to conduct this. They were quite different, one being old, one being not so old. One we knew a lot about because we'd done a post-implementation review on it. the other one we had a different set of information. So I think that was a factor. And another factor that I was very impressed with was the way you tailored what you asked people based on who they were and where you thought you could extract the most relevant information, rather than going out with questions that were one size fits all. I liked your design, that you started from base questions and then you modified and targeted. I thought that was something that contributes to the effectiveness, so you should credit yourselves with that as well for paragraph 31.
Okay, we now move on to the technical detail, so I'm going to hand over to a wiser voice than myself, Aisha.
Thanks. So I'll start with Agenda Paper 11B. So this is an educational paper that summarizes feedback from users, preparers, and national standard setters about employee benefit disclosures. So almost all users that we spoke to focused primarily on defined benefit plans. The big picture for most of those users is that the information they get today about defined benefit plans is often not effective in meeting their objectives. They shared their primary objectives, which are described in Table 1, starting on page 4 of the paper. Users said that their most important objectives are those that relate to expected cash flows and the effect on the primary financial statement. Table 2 on page 9 provides a summary of the items of information that users said would could be used to effectively meet their objectives on defined benefit plans. And paragraphs 20 to 77 of the paper then discusses each item of information in detail, covering how critical users consider the information to be and feedback from other stakeholders about cost and other consequences. Almost all users regarded two items of information as particularly critical. So the first is the expected contributions into the defined benefit plans, be it as agreed with trustees or as internally budgeted by management. The second is an explanation and disaggregation of the amounts recognized in the primary financial statement. Many users would also like to see a wider sensitivity analysis, as well as an explanation of the difference between the IAS 19 valuation and other pension plan valuations that might be discussed in the financial statement. In terms of the feedback from other stakeholders, many GPF members and a few ASAF members supported disclosure of expected contributions into the defined benefit plan. They said that they expect cash flows to be the most relevant information for users, and noted that when users ask questions about those pension plans, those questions normally relate to the cash flow impact. Many GPF and ASAF members expressed that some items of information will be particularly challenging and costly to provide. So this primarily related to wider sensitivity analysis and explanation of the different pension valuations. ASAF members did not raise any specific regulatory consequences of users' suggested items of information. However, a few ASAF members commented that some items of information raise questions about the extent to which forward-looking information should be included in financial statements. I mentioned earlier that users focus primarily on defined benefit plans, so it isn't the case that they just disregard the other types of plans that we summarize in paragraph 5. What we heard from them is that for those other types of employee benefits, they think the risks associated with them are well understood, and it's unlikely that they would make any adjustments in their analysis as a result of those. When users do analyze those other employee benefit plan disclosures, their primary objective is to understand the impact on the primary financial statements. Finally, this paper discusses the feedback received so far from the IFRS taxonomy team. So the IFRS taxonomy currently includes a few common practice elements which indicate potentially useful information that is not required by IAS 19. These elements relate to amounts recognized in the primary financial statement for both defined benefit plans and termination benefits. So with that overview, I'll turn it over to the board for any questions or comments on the feedback.
Firstly, thank you for the paper. I found it really interesting to get a bit of insight into what's important, and particularly on the focus on the defined benefit plans. I thought that was interesting. A couple of observations with no sort of, not much assistance in terms of direction, I'm afraid, and so not many wise words, Catherine, but just a couple of thoughts. What struck me in a couple of places in terms of the information that the users were interested in and what they would like to see is that it really highlighted to me that we're going to have to be conscious of what we think our role is and what our role isn't in terms of IFRS financial statements. And a couple of the things that struck me was a desire, which I completely understand from a user perspective, to have a, you know, as good a picture as possible about expected future contributions, which is very forward-looking. And is that our role or not, particularly in the actual financial statements? And the second one was an interest and a desire perhaps to understand and perhaps even get reconciliations between the calculations that are made and the amounts recognised in accordance with our requirements and what other valuation methodologies and numbers might look like and why there's a difference between the two. Now, again, I can see why if I was a user of financial statements, I might be very interested to understand that, but is it our role to explain, you know, what calculations other might be required for other purposes? For example, when we were doing IFRS 9 and doing the ECL calculations, they are different to what you would do for a expected loss calculation for regulatory purposes. And I know in other forums users have suggested that it would be helpful if banks could explain what's the same and what's different, but I don't recall that there was ever a suggestion that that would be our role. So I think we're going to have some interesting, you know, questions to juggle what might be very legitimate user needs with where we draw our boundaries in terms of what's appropriate for us to focus on. Also, just one small point in terms of signalling. I'm guessing there'll be at least a number of corporates who'll be watching this project avidly, hoping we're going to be deleting disclosure requirements. Now, that's, of course, not our, you know, objective per se, but I think it might be helpful to, in addition, understand where there were things they asked for and whether we already require them, to have seen where we've asked for stuff that actually they didn't suggest they needed, so we could give a bit of hope for people that actually we are being even-handed in terms of the direction of our considerations.
Nick?
Thank you. I think what really struck me from this paper was the consistency of the message from the feedback. It was very strong from across the users that we met in terms of particular items. And when I look at table one on page four, particularly those first three items, A, B, and C, in some respects they're all getting at the same thing, I think, which is around ultimately the future cash flows. I hear what Sue says in terms of what is our role here, and we have to think about that. I think also we have to be careful in interpreting that request. I don't think it's for a schedule of 50 years out of cash flows. I think we've got equally realistic in terms of what they would like here. But it is, it's a very strong, consistent message. Indeed, I think when we go on to IFRS 13, there was a consistency of message there as well. So I think that's powerful to have. And indeed, I should say, when we first identified 19 as a standard to look at, one quiet Friday afternoon, I did my own wish list before the staff even started and have only just revealed it to them. And apart from perhaps me not being quite so enthusiastic about sensitivity analysis, it lines up very well with Table 2 in terms of the items we have identified. And high on that list again was the cash flows, and understanding the difference between cash flows that are there to reduce the deficit and other cash flows. So I understand and appreciate the issues, but I think we will have to clearly focus on that in particular. But overall, it's the strength and the consistency of the message which shines through to me.
Beryl?
So again, like others, I think this was a very good paper, and it helped bring a lot of things together. One of the things I found interesting about it that I hadn't necessarily thought about before is, in addition to thinking about extra disclosures that we might believe would be useful and thinking about disclosures that we think are redundant or can be dropped, we may also need to start thinking about disclosures that are badly done. And in this particular one, it comes out that there are quite a number of wish list items we would really like to see, we would appreciate, that are already in IS19, that are already part of what IS19 is requiring. And it suggests that this might be a more nuanced effort than perhaps I'd been thinking. IS19, in some ways, has actually got its leading paragraph, is a good paragraph in describing precisely the things that people would like to see. But people then, somewhere between that leading paragraph and the rest, seem to have lost the plot a little bit.
Three comments about this, and I think it's very brave to deal with a standard that's as complex as IS-19 and is seen as technical. So, again, compliments for getting a whole group of people from outside the organization to think about something that is a daunting standard. This may be somewhat related to what Daryl just said about kind of improving the application. Some of the issues in here, and thinking about that agenda paper A, paragraph 5C, struck me as also kind of begging for guidance on how you assess the materiality of different disclosures, because I think it's not only the quantitative materiality in terms of the amount of the obligation, the amount of the expense, the cash flow contribution, but what this has done is highlight a lot of qualitative factors that make people more and less interested in detailed disclosures, like are your sensitivities linear or nonlinear? Do you have a closed or open plant? You know, and so it may be worth thinking about whether one way to address this and help people is potentially even an additional example in the materiality practice statement that pull together some of these factors. I think that doesn't answer the paper 11A. You know, do we require some things? Do we just illustrate how you could satisfy it? But I think it might be kind of Daryl's complimentary effort. Second is an impression I had, and I can't say it's this sentence or this paragraph, but a message I took, and I'd just like you to think about it, is whether users are saying we might get a lot of data, but it's particularly helpful when we can see exactly how it maps back to the amounts that are recognized in the primary financial statements. And we might, in some cases, get lots of data, but we don't really see the connections. Now, I don't think we're going to go as far as saying there's a presumption that you always have to do tabular presentation of information. It does point to that being a powerful tool. But I think we might want to draw out that point about clearer links between information we require and how it relates to amounts recognized in the primary financial statements. And the third comment, just think about this as you're moving forward. In Table 2, Item 7 is fair value of plants disaggregated by asset types. And there were several comments from users that were talking about additional information they'd like about assets. And I'm scratching my head a bit about why they are so interested in assets in the whoa, don't lose your balance. And I'm not objecting to it. I think I just need to understand better what their interest is rather than on the things they said they wanted, because you know, in many of these cases, I don't know, but I'm guessing the management of the assets may be outsourced. You know, they might not be actively managed in-house. So I'm just seeking to understand better what underlies that group.
Back in on that, just to clarify. Indeed, there was a research paper presented at the forum we had in Brussels in 2017 about pension fund asset allocation disclosure. And there the big issue is what the other is, and the other has grown over time. Okay. And the other could clearly be taking on more risk, investment hedge funds, or it could be pursuing a liability-driven investment strategy, i.e. de-risking the fund, and you have no idea, looking at the other, what that is. Generally, the asset allocation will happen in-house rather than being done by the third-party manager. So I think it's just trying to... And those things are very different, whether it's a hedge fund compared to an LDI strategy, and the other's just grown. So I think it's as simple as that.
Martin.
Yeah, I also have to say, a very good paper. And for me, it has really demonstrated what I always thought, okay, that users are more interested really in cash flows instead of recognized and measured assets or liabilities. And for me, that highlighted, okay, that is very good input, but I think it will be a difficult step for us to what we do with that. I think a little bit like Sue, because what is the purpose of financial statements? To give direct input into the valuation models of the users, or is it more to give a kind of assets, liabilities, income, and expenses, and then analysts maybe should draw their conclusion and do their forecast on future cash flows and make it an input. So for me, it is more directly input into the valuation models and should we really go this step? I don't have an answer to that. But I think that and that is what I said, why I said it is very good input, because it clearly demonstrates. Focus is on direct input to the valuation models and provided by the companies, which I thought was the job of the users in the past, but now they want to give it to the entities and makes their work. And therefore, I think it will be a difficult thing for us then in the next step to decide what we are doing with it.
Well, we should just go back to cash accounting. Doug?
Oh, thank you. I really like this paper, and also I really like that mechanism of two tables. So one table across the second one. And then I just want to test how it works with the one of the disclosure possible requirement, number 5 in the table 2. I have slight concern on this requirement. So in this table 2, number 5, explanation on the differences between various benefit plans. So you require to explain what is the difference of the other plans. And then you said this is for the purpose of A, B, and D in the table 2. So I was trying to understand why explanation of other plans are useful for to achieve the objective of A, B, and D. And try to understand. I could understand to some extent, but not quite. So then. Because the requirement to ask different plan is a lot of hassle for preparers, because they have already prepared the plan for required in the IS 19, and that this is relevant for the financial statement already. So then they may have different variation, but if you are to ask why there is a difference, it's difficult. So they want to know, what is the purpose, why you asked me to do that? And then go to A, B, D, but not quite. So therefore, could you just explain why we need number 5 requirement and why it relates to A, B, and D?
Yes, we can. So A, B, and D have a bit of a connection in terms of users needing information so that they can forecast, so that they know what to put in their analysis, etc. And the value, or one of the values of information that reconciles differences between different valuations that have been applied, is that it gives users a complete understanding of the different aspects that they might feed in to the forecast, or to the valuations that they are preparing for themselves. So if you imagine a circumstance in which a user was faced with a set of financial statements that contained an IAS 19 valuation and, say, a triennial valuation, and they were different, the user might be going, OK, which one do I use? And the reconciliation or explanation of differences between the two would enable them to take an informed view of which set of information they want to then plug into their forecasts.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. It does. However, that may deviate from the purpose of IFRS, because the IFRS is an accounting standard. And for the accounting standard purposes, we invented IAS 19. And this variation is most suitable for the financial statements. And then all of a sudden you are required to explain the difference between other plans. I don't know, because I followed IFRS 9 and IS 19, and then what is the point I have to explain? That is difficult for the preparer to understand. I do understand user want to the information other than recognition requirement in the IFRS 19. So therefore, I do understand other variation information may be useful, but if we start it in such a way, it never ends. So if you have other variation, then that might be more useful than IS 19 variation. So please give me that variation. And that never ends. So therefore, I feel some danger of the requirement, this number 5.
Could I just clarify? I think, if I'm understanding correctly, that the underlying point that you're making is similar to what Sue and Martin have raised as a concern, in that you can understand why users would want the information, but the question is it our role almost to ask preparers to provide that particular information?
Yeah, I understand that is our role, but within the boundary of IS 19 requirement, because if we, you know, if we get the order from the users and then ask the preparers, then it could deviate from IFRS. So we could do whatever they like, and we can please the users. And then all of a sudden ask preparers. That is not our job. We are the in the body to create the standard, and then the standard is the minimum requirement. So therefore, if we start deviating in such a way, it's called the escalation of disclosure. So that is what I'm afraid.
Councillor Azza.
Yeah, I have a question. Because I understand the approach, I understand where you come from, how you develop your paper, and it indeed brings a lot of clarity in the reasoning. But trying to project into the next step and how the requirements are going to look like with the focus on the objectives, how do you intend to present that? To me, as I already said, I mean, the focus on objectives is important. And to me, they're important because that's how the preparers would anchor the materiality judgment. So if I start from a list that is list the objectives, I'm fine. But if I end up with a list of information which looks like the previous one supplementary rewarded, I have the feeling we're losing the benefit of the approach. So I also understand that a number of items of information serve different objectives, and that you necessarily have had to take that into account to get to a clear picture. But ultimately, if we want the objective to be the anchor to materiality judgment, we have to define how the requirements are going to be presented. So it's a question at this stage.
No, that's fine. If I may make a few comments which may or may not completely answer your question and possibly risk a bit of repetition. Everything that you've said in terms of our when we develop the guidance and our thinking in terms of moving the project forward is absolutely consistent with the direction that we are thinking in. We think the objectives are absolutely critical, and that's been key through all the feedback we heard from the principles of disclosure discussion paper and such. That said, the recent effort to talk to stakeholders, we felt we couldn't talk about objectives in isolation, because I could imagine that for many people, and I probably include myself in this, if you discuss just objectives and don't allow the conversation to extend to what would satisfying that objective look like, what would be an example of what might do that, that's really helpful in understanding exactly what users want and what they are trying to achieve. So it is at this stage, in terms of outreach and understanding objectives and sharing all the detail we've heard, we are talking about the two things, and I can understand that being confusing. When it comes to developing proposed amendments to the standards, again, given the discussions that we had last year, we are of the view that we got to the point in those discussions with different views around the table that we needed real examples to work with. So objectives, clear objectives, what users want, and, you know, what might meet those objectives in order to fully understand and articulate them. The discussion about exactly how they will be presented is one that is still to come once we have done all of that thinking. But certainly from our perspective, and in accordance with the guidance, the intention is that the objectives would be written as an entity shall disclose information that enables users to do whatever it is. So the objectives would absolutely be associated with a compliance need. The objectives have to be complied with, and therefore using those to make judgments would be explicit in the way that we would develop them. What I wouldn't want to comment on now, because I think we still have another board discussion to come, is the exact language that we would expect to use with regards to the associated information, albeit that I think including that in one way or another is necessary in order to communicate a clear picture of what those objectives are doing. I don't know to what extent that helps with your question.
I don't think we're going to answer my question today, but I think in the where we develop our next steps, we absolutely need to answer that question. Because when we consult, we need to make sure that the requirement is effective. So we need to have people answering us, yes, this I can anchor my materiality judgment on this objective, and I will use the list of requirements to find out how I'm going to meet that objective in the best manner. And that's from everything that you've put together, it shows that it is not an easy task. It's a difficulty in the approach.
Jen Chow.
Thank you. First of all, thank you. Very good paper and a very good analysis and the feedback. I think I learned a lot of based on your research. But the interesting thing, the general impression when I read the paper is that generally users are happy with those extra information provided, if possible, provided by the entities. But preparers seems always think that, okay, it's costly, it's impractical, so they got different views when I read the paper. So it's really relevant to, as Sue and Martin mentioned, that what's the law? What's the law of the standard setting? What's the law of the financial system? And what's the law of the user's decision and their information needs? Just a very simple example about information for sensitive analysis. And we're going further about the wider sensitive analysis. When I come back thinking about this kind of analysis, should it be done by the preparer or should it be done by users itself? And prepare simply provides some general information to them. And once interest rates increase or decrease, users may, based on those information available, to do some wider sensitive analysis, something like that. So I think there is a clear role in mind to define prepare should provide what kind of information, and users should do what kind of job based on those information. But here it seems that not very clear. But why? I think the reason because of the methodology. We're going through the analysis, whole analysis, and I think I also mentioned before, we're starting from users and then identify users' objective. This is user's objective, but user's objective or user's disclosure objective does not necessarily resulting become the financial statement's objective or disclosure objective. That is another way. Yeah, I think user's objective is much broader than financial statement's objective. So that results in different, reaction. Different views come out. So I think the good thing is we collect the feedback from the users and the preparers, then we should make decision really based on the standard setting process from the financial statement itself, not to simply rely on the user's objective. I think users always demand a lot of information and the decision model will be very broad differently. So this is relevant to next step. How to balance, how to pick up those information we can do from the user's perspective and from the prepared as a response. Something we can do, something actually we cannot do. That is your job. And you should collect information and do further analysis to meet your objective. Something we can do, we can improve some information and improve disclosure further to meet your objective. And thirdly, when I read the table one, about the user's disclosure objective. This is user's disclosure objective. Originally, when we developed our guidance, I think, as you mentioned, that I think the objective, this is the objective. So this is a high-level disclosure objective, not so specific. But when I go through the table one, it's very specific disclosure requirement. And this is requirements actually users need, but it's really should be results our specific disclosure objective, not detailed requirement. That is a different way. So I think this is why I think some prepared response very clearly. It's too cost. It seems not principle-based. Some because they have to comply with those very detailed requirements.
First of all, I think we need to go through the suggested disclosures one by one rather than, and so I'm not saying that I'm actually in favour of all of these or any of them, but let's do that when we come to that. But in terms of user requirements, and they do require much more information that comes from financial statements. I think that's obvious. But financial statements also need to be relevant and remain relevant. And ultimately, these are our customers. We have to, if they're not going to use it, there's no point in producing them. So we do need to listen to them, both in terms of the information they want and also listen to them when the information they don't want, that sometimes we decide to provide to them. And I think that's so. I think this feedback is very important. I don't think we want to outsource our work to standard setters or to the accounts. And I would draw an analogy to bank, some bank loans. Let's say I have a portfolio of bank loans. I can reasonably predict the cash flows on that my liability is there for the foreseeable future. A pension liability, which is to all intents and purposes a debt-like liability, is a black box at the moment. I have no way of doing that. Cash flows are important to users. They've become more important to users over years, but it's not to say that they're uninterested in other parts of the financial statements, and it goes back to, I think, the comments about being able to tie the pension information back to the various financial statements. It's almost going back to what Daryl asked about, are there some bad disclosure requirements in there at the moment? I don't know if they're necessarily bad, but certainly we have found examples of good practice that fulfills requirements and helps users at the same time by making it very clear, for instance, how it does tie back to the primary financial statements. So whether it's through examples and practice statements or through tightening up our requirements, I'm not sure what the route is, but it's a very valid point. For me, the concerns around the cash flows in particular have been a long-standing issue. I think we need to be proportional in how we reflect that. But we really do need to listen to this input, I think. And the last word on cash flows, which makes this very nice, is the feedback from the Global Preparers Forum is this wouldn't be expensive to do. So it's something users have asked for, preparers are prepared to do.
A couple of comments. First, a quick question, though. Just paragraph 69C, should that be the expected and actual rate of return? I don't see why somebody would want either or. Because later it says they want to be able to compare. So that should be an and. That's 69C.
Yeah, I think essentially we heard both, so we will double check.
It is a small point. The other thing I wanted to just a small comment on six. I think in paragraph 58 and six, people talked about they wanted to learn a bit about the way the entity intends to manage its defined benefit plans. And I didn't see that as a separate item, but it shows up there, and it seems to me to be an issue. It's like it's not in table two. How do you manage it? What are your plans to manage it? Which would take in anticipated contributions. It would take in funding policy. It would also take in asset investment policy. And I'm not sure if that could be wrapped up in one thing. I think just on the expected contributions, I think often entities, I'll set aside normal versus deficit. I think sometimes you get a special deal if you're deep in deficit, you can do extra contributions. But in a normal world, normally entities, I believe, are limited on the top end by tax deductibility and on the bottom end by the funding of their plan. And so they normally will do their contributions in any year in that range. They could go over them, the tax deductibility, but they typically wouldn't. And I think in some of the comments, like on 60B, there's hints of that range within which they operate. So just, again, it seemed to me that was coming out a little bit, whether you might do more about thinking about the range within which they operate and it being a policy. And then I had one last comment on paragraph 46, A and B. It's funny, there are fundamentally three valuations in the A and B. As I understand it, a lot of countries do a going concern valuation and a solvency valuation. Canada does both, at least in some provinces. So the solvency valuation is different than the going concern. And one of the things that you kind of mentioned both, but I'm not sure to what degree any users were aware or expressed a preference to see both if they're available, or are they just happy with going concern? What we're doing in our standard is a going concern with the projected unit credit method. And so the solvency would be something quite radically different. Its solvency is typically just, you know, like you actually stop everything today and pay everybody out based on what they've worked today and what they're owed. And it's, in today's environment, typically a harder to be in the black on solvency than in the black on going concern. So again, and sometimes when I've heard people say, I want to understand the difference, that would be a big one. And again, I think we've got the three. And the other one is the buyout, which I think is basically, I think, a going concern with a profit margin. But we may want to just think about these three generic, and then, you know, which jurisdictions ask for one or two or three, again, just in sorting out as we go forward.
I was thinking about the issue, in fact, of the boundary of financial statements that have been raised. And I wanted to have my memory reignited. I think in the disclosure initiative paper, discussion paper, we had some form of definition of what the content of the notes that explain what is in the financial statements, supplements. And I think there was something about forward-looking information which is included as long as it participates in the measurement of items or in the disaggregation of recognized items in the balance sheet. I don't know what we've decided. In fact, my memory is failing me as to what we've decided we do with this. But I think as a minimum, it would be useful to have it in order to scrutinize the results of our work in this disclosure standard by standard to see what information fits in that boundary, what does not. And that would give us the good guideline in order to scrutinize.
There's also some discussion in the conceptual framework as well.
Mm-hmm. Don't remember where it comes from.
No, exactly what you were talking about, I think, is reflected actually in the revised conceptual framework, and it talks about forward-looking information effectively supporting the information about the recognised assets, liability, income and expenses for the position at the reporting entity date.
You know it by heart.
Not quite.
I don't remember where I read it.
Just to be clear, I wasn't saying that I thought we couldn't include it. I was just... indirectly alluding to what you are, which is remembering, I think we need to think about what our anchors are for making the decisions.
Anne? I wanted to make a couple of comments about taxonomy, Ayesha, if I may.
Of course.
Because the feedback from the taxonomy is very different in terms of IAS 19 and IFRS 13. And so in this paper there's a reference to a couple of things, but there's not a lot of evidence that we can build on, unlike in the IFRS 13, where we had actually done a common practice review, a very thorough people have done a very thorough review. So we've got very good evidence there, and you've documented it well in that paper, which we'll look at next. But here there is very little, but the upside is that AAISH is going to do a very detailed review on IAS 19, looking at the common practice. So what we can learn from common practice is the people, the disclosures that entities choose to make over and above what the standard requires. So it's a very interesting and important piece of information for us. Another source that doesn't come from necessarily from discussions, but it comes from direct observation, what people are doing. So we look forward to seeing all your work on IAS 19, and I know that you're going to build that on the foreign private issuers, so you're going to use the IFRS taxonomy filings in the United States. So we look forward to seeing that in due course. Thank you.
Mary?
The point about, again, both boundary of financial statements and the, you know, the interest we saw reported here about other valuations and reconciling to them, et cetera, you know, wish list. Maybe one of the things we should think about when items are identified that may be produced, but we may be concluding they're outside the boundary of financial statements, at least requirements, is to think about, say, you know, a requirement to identify when there is such information and where it is available, rather than saying it becomes part of the financial statements. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I'm not saying I want that, but just maybe thinking about that's another category of how we treat this type of information.
Martin.
When the future cash flow things, when I agree there is a difference between if you're using a cash flow model, discounted cash flow model, and then maybe we have to disclose some input to this cash flow model. But also for that, I think it is a kind of question which we have to answer at some point in time. Do we ask preparers to do all the kind of measurement work because the users only want the cash flows and want to give the discount rate and all others by themselves? So why do all the work by the entities? But that is one question. The other is then to also provide disclosure of future cash flows which are not included in the measurement of assets and liabilities, which is on future transactions, on future, because it was also here a kind of future deficits. What is your expectation about the future cash flows of deficits and what you do? And I think that is outside the financials. But if it is inside the financial, I think we must have a debate. What do we want? Do we want to have kind of giving all the detailed disclosure of that users can use the calculations by themselves to use different valuation models? Or do we think, okay, it is our role to say, okay, that is a valuation model, which I think we should do, because otherwise it can be different users maybe have different kind of required input for their own valuation of the asset and liabilities. But I think I don't have an answer to that. I think, but we must have this debate, and that has demonstrated to me that is a kind of question. And how far do we go? Because if we do all that, then I agree, because when many preparers expect from this project a reduction of disclosure. Mm-hmm. But if we're doing all that, I think we will double it.
Thank you. They are the same concern. But you already analyzed the kind of an overlapping requirement from us and from other regulations. So this is a kind of area, common area, everybody is interested in. So in your paper 59, paragraph 59, you already analyzed that point very well. So I think you need to explore more this kind of overlap of other regulatory, but as Tom said, the three valuations, you know, some jurisdiction is asking you to disclose it, you know, some kind of, also there are many things, you know, this area is quite a special area, many people are interested in. So not just the accounting standard, but the other regulations, so please consider that.
Okay, so I think we should move on to
mm-hmm.
the next paper.
Yes, of course. So moving on to agenda paper 11C. So this is also an educational paper that summarizes feedback from stakeholders but focusing on fair value measurement disclosures. Contrary to what we heard on employee benefits, users are broadly happy with the information they get today on fair value measurement. One overarching message from users was about the proper application of materiality. Many users said that they often get a lot of information about immaterial measurements and little information about those measurements that are material to the entity. Many users added that they do not use detailed fair value measurement disclosures, and this was either because those disclosures are rarely material to the companies they monitor, or because the detailed disclosures do not relate to the entity's most significant assets and liabilities. Users that do use detailed fair value disclosures said those disclosures help to support their objectives, and user objectives are described in Table 1 on page 4 of the paper. Table 2 on page 5 summarizes the items of information users told us could be used to meet their objectives. Paragraph 17 to 56 of the paper then discusses each item of information in detail, including feedback from stakeholders other than users about cost and other consequences. Almost all users highlighted the usefulness of two specific items of information. The first is a breakdown of the types of assets and liabilities within each level of the fair value hierarchy. The second is information about the inputs that was used in determining the fair value measurement. Many users also said that information that explains how an entity determined the level to which its asset or liability belongs is important, and this was for them to assess the boundaries between the levels of the fair value hierarchy for that particular entity. Users were generally most concerned with differentiating between level 2 and level 3 fair value measurements. They branded level 2 as the new black box because there is a lack of transparency about those, in their view, those measurements, especially for entities that have their most significant assets and liabilities in level 2. In light of that concern, some users called for additional disclosures on level 2 fair value measurements. GPF and ASAF members expressed concerns about the high cost of preparing some of the suggested items of information, particularly that which relates to a wider sensitivity analysis on level 3 fair value measurement. In addition, those members doubted the benefit of additional level 2 disclosures to users, and they said that detailed disclosure should only be required for level 3 fair value measurements that are the subjective ones. Finally, as Anne mentioned earlier, the paper talks about the feedback we received so far from the IFRS taxonomy team. So the team has recently completed a common practice review of IFRS 13, where they identified a number of issues with existing IFRS 13 disclosure requirements that might affect the board's review of the disclosure sections of the standard. For example, the common practice highlights items of voluntary information being disclosed by some companies. This might indicate some items of information that's useful to users but not currently required. Those issues are summarized in paragraph 62 and discussed in more detail in Appendix A. So again, with that overview, I'll turn it over to the board for questions or comments on fair value measurement.
Okay. Martin.
And I found it quite interesting that it demonstrated that this is also a topic of materiality regarding this kind of level of information regarding for financial instruments, information for non-banks, I think was what people said, okay, is not material and they don't care. And I think we have to do some work on that. On the other hand side, man, if it is material, then to require more detailed information for level 2, I understand that. But I think also that is a kind of, I have not understood what investors would do with that information. Because, man, if you have a big bank which has, I don't know, billions of level 2 assets, different kind, with a lot of different input, what investors will do with that information. Man, I'm hearing that, but I need to think of the next step. We have to understand if he would do something, what is the reason why they want to have that? Because I think other than in IAS 19, I think nobody will try to recalculate then the fair values of level 2. I think that is not the purpose. And therefore, for me, it is understand to get more comfort about the, I don't know, kind of input, which is a kind of how difficult it is, how sensitive it is, how could, I don't know what, and I think I have missed kind of the link between what is the objective of that and why do they want to have that.
And three things. I think Martin's point is a really good one that we have to keep asking ourselves throughout the project of, it's not just what do you want, but tell us what you want to do with it so that we understand the use and can think about it. Sometimes it might be because of the boundary issue, but sometimes it might be to see if we can, let's say, consulting with preparers, identify other ways of, you know, achieving that objective. The second point is, you know, there are times when you've explained what the reason people gave you, and it's it gives them additional confidence, and you know, the requirement to be a bit more transparent gives them some confidence, and I think it's helpful that people are honest about that, but I'm not sure that that's the best way to deliver confidence in the robustness of the information by providing ever more detail. So I think we have to identify that as a problem about the faithfulness of financial statements and whether there's anything else we have to do with it. So good that you're getting that data, and I think maybe we want to collect those points and think about them. And the third one is there are a couple of places in which my reaction, and one of them was paragraph 22, I think, about the judgment why something is level 2 versus level 3. What came to mind is the IS-1 requirement on disclosure of significant judgments and significant estimates. On the one hand, I think the more we cite that, the more we kind of undermine it as an overarching requirement. On the other, it is there and it's applicable. So that I think that's just something we want to think about, how we balance the explicit reference to that, because it, for a couple of these places, at least, I think the general requirement in IS-1 is part of the answer.
Sue?
A couple of things to do with sensitivity. So one is that I'm not sure that it's terribly clear in this, either in the standard or in the feedback we get from users and preparers about what the sort of purpose of the sensitivity analysis is and what it's meant to show. I think it was designed to show or to put people on notice that this is an area where you need to make a lot of judgment and where a difference in valid assumptions at the reporting date could make quite a difference in the valuation, and so it's trying to give people a sense around that. But I'm not sure if that's what people understand or whether that's what users actually want. So I think it's a very good example of where having a better objective might be helpful in terms of being clear about what the disclosure is that you're aiming for and what you're trying to understand. A little bit related to that, I think it would be helpful, as Martin said, to understand for those who think we need more on level 2, what is it about that information they think they need and why do they need it, sort of linked back to that. I wonder whether some of this request for the level 2 information, again, which is why it would be good to understand, it might be because there, I think, is some level of angst that because the disclosures are so much more onerous for a level 3 valuation than for a level 2, that there might be a suspicion that people are putting things in level 2 that maybe should really be in level 3 just to avoid the disclosures. So I wonder if it's a backdoor sort of attempt at a market discipline on the levelling. And I'm not sure that's a good reason to have it, but yeah.
Going forward, can we also refer to the feedback and information that we got in the PIR on 13? Because we did get a lot of feedback on disclosure. We concluded, as you know, standard working as intended, so we didn't act on those disclosures, and particularly we didn't act to take any away, which is what we were hearing at the time there were some people that wanted. So I know that in the PIR we've said that we will feed the findings through to this project, so can we please start doing that and make sure they're visible, and so that people who took the time to be involved in the PIR don't feel that we did that and we're now ignoring it, we've now got a new favourite toy or something.
So I've got three sort of interlinked points which follow on a bit from what Sue said and also what Martin said. So first of all, I had the impression reading the paper that some of the requests from users might be more about wanting to know more about the assets and liabilities rather than necessarily about the fair value measurement per se. And I think we probably need to keep that boundary fairly clear. I think IFRS 13 really ought to be talking about what goes into the fair value measurement, not everything you might want to know about something that happens to be measured at fair value. That's the job of the underlying standard, I would think. Secondly, on the sensitivity analysis, and this also applies to IS-19 as well, I think it's reasonably clear in both standards, to us at least, that it's doing what the... It's about what the framework now calls measurement uncertainty. It's not about outcome uncertainty and about possible future changes and risk exposures. It's focusing very much on the difficulty of doing measurement. And again, I got the sense from both papers, actually, that wasn't necessarily totally clear to users. And certainly from past conversations, I think it's not been clear to people. We could perhaps clarify that. Thirdly, on the level two thing, I think there's a risk here that if we're clear about what the objective of the level three disclosures is focusing on the things that are hard to value. So it really is focusing very much, I think, on measurement uncertainty. And so the concern is that if something's classified as level two, it's that somehow people maybe have manipulated it a bit to get something that's really hard to value and called it level two rather than level three. Mm-hmm. I think if it's been appropriately classified as level two, if you look at how level two's defined, that says that the effect of the unobservable inputs isn't going to have a significant effect. If it's not going to have a significant effect, then it's hard to see how disclosures about the measurement uncertainty could possibly be material. So it seems to me that if there is a problem, it might be that the boundary between level two and level three isn't being policed appropriately.
Okay. The last paper, do you expect an extensive discussion, because we are getting cooked here in this very, very warm room.
They are working on the temperature.
Yeah? Okay.
I cannot predict how much board members will have to say, but I can try and keep the tape short.
Be a warning to the board members.
Okay, on agenda paper 11D then, really the purpose of this paper is to ask the board if you are happy with the approach that we plan to take to the analysis and recommendations we'll bring to you over the coming months. I won't repeat everything that's in the paper, just to highlight that for us, one thing that has been extremely interesting in developing our thinking and just generally is the contrast between what we've heard on these two standards. So the other thing we wanted to highlight in this paper at this time to give you a chance to comment on the big picture rather than the detail we will be bringing on each standard in the coming months is about that contrast. One of the reasons the board selected these two standards in the first place is because they felt the two standards would test the guidance in different ways, and that has absolutely proven to be the case in terms of the feedback that we've heard. So taking IAS 19 first, Aisha mentioned the feedback we've heard is that the disclosures given about employee benefits are often not effective in meeting user objectives, or at least some user objectives, and at the same time preparers tell us that a lot of that information is quite onerous to produce in the first place. Putting all of that together then, we think a potential absolutely key benefit of applying the guidance to this standard is that if we can develop and articulate disclosure objectives that absolutely communicate and require preparers to comply with what users want and why they want it, it may well be the case that it will lead to information being disclosed that is more useful than what is given today and potentially also helps with some preparer concerns about cost. So ultimately, we're recommending in this paper that the approach to our IAS 19 review explores that possibility to the maximum. I won't repeat everything that's in the paper. Contrasting that then with IFRS 13, where users tell us they're broadly happy with the information that they get today, albeit that many of them don't necessarily use all of it, and they have some questions about how materiality has been considered in applying those disclosures. Therefore, in light of that, you could question the value of touching these disclosures at all, given that users say they are getting useful information. However, again, we on the staff team, based on everything we've heard, see potential real significant benefit of applying the guidance to IFRS 13, albeit that we think those benefits are different. In this case, we do not think that developing detailed, specific, helpful objectives will necessarily lead to disclosure content that is fundamentally different. Instead, we think the main advantage of those objectives is that it will help preparers understand exactly why users want the information and thereby give preparers the tools that they need to make really effective materiality judgments, focus on what users really care about, and indeed avoid spending time on things that users aren't going to necessarily look at or ask about. So the approach that is in Agenda Paper 11D is designed for each of the two standards to focus on what we see the primary benefit of this process for, given everything we've heard. And the question for the board on this paper is whether you are happy with the approach that we plan to take to our analysis, or whether you have any advice or suggestions for us to keep in mind now.
So, yes, I support the overall approach. I think it's worth remembering when we go back to our draft guidance, and we've discussed, particularly in relation to the pension issue, some different aspects. There is a cost-benefit stage to our draft guidance, and going back, reflecting on that, this isn't all about just giving users everything that they want to make their model work. And we know for some of the items that have been raised that the costs are much more significant than others. The cash flows, as I said before, is one where the preparers thought the costs were very limited. But we do need to explore both aspects in terms of looking at the guidance we have. I also think we need to think about how that draft guidance gets developed and the iterative process that we go through. And I think, Mary, you said earlier on that it's harder doing this with an existing standard than with a new standard. I think it's the other way around for users. Actually, it's much easier for them to do it with an existing standard because they've got a benchmark of information to begin with. We can take along examples for the meeting, so it may even itself out, but I think there are different perspectives on whether it's harder or easier. But certainly as we revise that guidance, we need to be mindful that it will be used both for new standards and existing standards, and we may need to differentiate aspects of the guidance to take account of different circumstances and different that. But overall, yes, happy with the approach. Thank you.
Catherine, your tee up made something click for me, which is the kind of the difference between IFRS 19 and IFRS 13. And if, as you work through IFRS, one of the things I think we should do is do the same kind of stand back and say, is this package delivering, you know, in terms of the package of proposed amendments to 13, does this package deliver enough incremental benefits to be worth the cost of change and, you know, putting something through the system at this time? You know, when we looked at IFRS 8 and our segment disclosures, there were, you know, the remaining package were things that we thought would be improvements. But in the end, we said, you know, they weren't such significant improvements that we thought they warranted it. I'm not reaching that conclusion about IFRS 13. But I think for both of them, and the one that just is maybe a bit more likely, we should ask ourselves that question. Because it also strikes me, as I think about some of the feedback we've heard and the comments we've made today, that 13 is the standard for which maybe some more educational guidance or comments about how to apply the existing requirements better, including scaling for materiality, is more the nature of the how we can get better disclosures. Doesn't mean we shouldn't ultimately put in clearer disclosure objectives, et cetera, but just be thinking about whether at this time the package that we have is worth it.
Doc.
Thank you. Just a comment on the blank page approach. I think it's an interesting approach, and it's very good to get the good picture of what the disclosure should be. But one thing we have to be careful is once we start with blank sheet paper, then it could be another set of requirements. Now, although we reconcile the current one and what kind of improvement we can make, but in the end, we may end up creating another brand new set of disclosure, which is looks different but similar, but still different. Then that makes preparer a hard time whether they should renew their system completely or they can just tweak current system. So it's same as what the Nick said to the users. So that is what we have to be careful.
Well, I support the approaches and distinct approaches per standard, given the feedback that you've received. I think, of course, we have to think of the cost-benefit of what we do. But I also would welcome, in fact, that these were selected as a testing base. And I think it's interesting also to go and meet constituents and see how a change in the way a set of requirements that is not fundamentally changed, but worded, organized, articulated differently, can help them do a better job. I think there is value in this consultation for the future. So I would not necessarily dismiss a consultation and a progress only on the basis that it's only the materiality judgment that would be made better. All the less so that in this particular project, in fact, it is around how materiality judgments are made that the problem needs to change. I mean, the practice needs to change.
Martin.
Yeah, I basically agree also with this approach, but I have only one warning, because we're hearing more and more that this, the defined benefit plans are not longer relevant, or the accounting for plans which are in existence maybe is not the right accounting and we have to change it. And I think we have to think about, if we have the next agenda consultation and people think we have to do more on changing the measurement and recognition criteria on, especially for these pension plans, then we have to think, okay, do we now do all the disclosure work if we then change measurement and recognition maybe? And to take this only into account that, because I was surprised by all the feedback from users that they concentrate so on this defined benefit plans. And that was also interesting for me. And because the standard is more about employment benefits and there are many others, and but the concentration should be on that. But then they say the accounting is not right, and if we now develop maybe the disclosure on what users think or others think is the wrong accounting, we should consider that.
Gary.
Yeah, I also agree with the overall approach, Catherine, but look at the IAS 19. A lot of the requests were to understand more of the funding and the cash contributions and benefits paid more so than the fire points, the expense accounting. The only caution on that is every day people quit companies and leave plans, and they may get hired with replacement, they may not get hired with replacement. So it's not a problem for if it's an actuarial managed plan to project out cash flows, perhaps more so the benefit payments, because contributions got a degree of variability to it. But once you go out beyond a year or two, as the demographics of the workforce have changed, you got to deal with, should you be talking about replacing those workers with people of equal tenure or perhaps 20 years younger, about the point in time they started? That's going to be a problem to do. So I'm not suggesting what we should or should not do. I think you need to be cognizant of that issue as you go forward with this and ask how would you do it. But ultimately, say these plans are, workforces are fixed and they decline. And the question is, how much are they replaced in that same plan, by the way?
Okay.
We would like to ask the question if everyone is happy.
Okay.
Can
we follow the staff's recommendation?
14.
Okay. Good. Well, thank you very much. We've got a lot of compliments. That's it. Five past four.